we chatted about it and tried to find out what was happening down here. And it was our decision, as we had non-refundable tickets, and as Mark Lemire was going to be here anyway, and we knew there'd be a few stalwart people showing up, that we had to rent a hotel suite and just talk to one another for the Internet. We're going to do it anyway, because our motto in Canada is the motto that thunders throughout Ulster, no surrender. This is a week that's pregnant with important dates. Today, April 24th, of course, is Canada's most famous political prisoner's birthday, his 65th birthday. And it gives me great satisfaction to think that at long last, Ernst can start collecting reparations from the Canadian state, because as a senior citizen, he can now start collecting his pension. Let me think. I think there was an important day earlier in the week, April 20th. I can't quite remember. Somebody else's birthday. Now, there are a great number of Canadians here today. Why don't you put up your hands, if you're from Canada? Don't be ashamed. We have about 10 Canadians from 4 provinces. The one who has come the farthest is from La Belle Province de Quebec. Gentlemen over here, we have people from Alberta, from Ontario, and from British Columbia. There was another important day. If you look at our Canadians, you may say, well, what's the matter with those people? All of them seem to have pink around their eyes and puffy cheeks, and their pockets are full of Kleenex. Well, what's the matter with those people? Well, the fact is, you see, April the 19th was a very important day in Canada, and our people have been mourning and crying and carrying on ever since. The Parliament of our Dominion had declared April the 19th Holocaust Remembrance Day. So, like good, loyal Canadians, I guess all my compatriots have been bawling their eyes out, I think. I don't know. That's what I'm told. In many ways, though, it does demonstrate our dispossession. April the 19th was declared Holocaust Remembrance Day by our Parliament for events that happened in another country to people that were not Canadian citizens at that time, and a group of people who, at 365,000, constitute a trifle over 1% of the citizens of our country of 31 million people. And one notes, for instance, that others who have suffered, for instance, Ukrainian Canadians, we have a very large number of Ukrainian Canadians, their compatriots lost between 8 and 10 million due to deliberate starvation under Stalin in the early 1930s. We have no Ukrainian Starvation Remembrance Day. There are a good many Irish Canadians who came out after the potato famine in the last century. We have no Irish Famine Day to commemorate those between 1.5 million and 2 million Irishmen who perished, partly through acts of God or nature, partly through human negligence. We have no such day in Canada. We have no such day for the very large number of German Canadians who came after the Second World War, many of the 16 million expellees. We have no Volksdeutsche Expellee Remembrance Day. We have no day to commemorate the clearance of the Scottish Highlands. Many Canadians are the descendants of the Scottish Highlands. We were simply ethnically cleansed to make room for sheep in the latter part of the 18th century. So it's only one minority group that gets recognized. I'm sure this is not any great news to you, but when you put it in that context, you see that it is very much part of our dispossession as European Canadians and Americans. Only one group seems to matter, and I think any basic sense of justice says that's just not fair. What I want to share with you in my time with you this afternoon is a look at the attack on free speech in Canada, and I think you'll see many similarities with what's happening in the United States. I'm going to pay particular attention to the man I say is Canada's most famous political prisoner, Ernst Sundell. Like your country, we have in our Constitution words that are very encouraging. Like your Bill of Rights, we have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and it talks about freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, freedom of thought, freedom of belief, all these good things that I think every one of us can subscribe to. The problem is, though, what the government giveth with one hand, it can taketh away with the other. Because while we have all these these high sounding rights, we find that they are all they're subject only to such restrictions as are demonstrably reasonable in a fair and democratic society. I can already see eyes beginning to close with this legalese. But what it has been, though, for the last 20 years is a field day for the lawyers and the judges. You know, what is reasonable in a free and democratic society? Because you see, they read democratic as being as any restriction that any legislature chooses to pass. So it may be it's democratic because they want to restrict freedom, but on the other hand, there's freedom. And anyway, most of the decisions in terms of freedom of speech have come down in favor of restriction and repression. I'm going to deal with three areas, and I'm going to end up with Ern Sundel. One area of attack on freedom of speech is the internet. Now, I think those of you who grew up in the pre-internet era have come to realize that this is probably the most important invention in terms of human communication since Gutenberg's invention of movable type. The world is changing. The world will never again be the same. Now, our country is probably more effectively restricted in terms of television, radio, and newspapers than your own country. But nonetheless, there would be the odd opportunity to get a letter to the editor in, maybe the odd television or radio commentary that might be worthwhile from time to time, but essentially it was pretty tightly controlled, and a whole range of ideas, including probably everything you would hear at this conference today, would not be permissible. So until the internet came along, a whole range of opinion was pretty much shuffled off to the side. Along came the internet, and we had the ability, and people of very modest means, to create their own website and to communicate. Suddenly, anybody can be a publisher. You don't have to be a multimillionaire to be able to buy a newspaper or a radio station or a television channel. You could be your own publisher, and you could exchange information almost instantly with the person down the street, across the nation, or across the world. Well, needless to say, this had the enemies of free speech frantic. Absolutely frantic. And both in your country and particularly in mine, the forces of repression did not take a long time to get organized. We have an outfit in Canada called the Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Institute. And they were in the forefront of trying to shut down dissident websites. And they tore through Canada, and chasing after ISPs, Internet Service Providers. And for the most part, these people were very, very much dedicated to freedom. Their resistance lasted all of about 30 seconds. So, but of course, because of the magic of the internet, we don't have to have an ISP in Canada. We can have an ISP in Estonia, an ISP in the United States. It doesn't matter. And that's, of course, what drives them crazy about the internet. There was one brave man who just simply said, as we do, no surrender. I have my business. I believe in freedom of speech, and I will rent space to whom I choose. That man is sitting over there in the white shirt, Bernard Klatt from British Columbia. Well, of course, they turned on the media, and all the jackals were fed news releases, and before you knew it, little Oliver in the South Okanagan, just above Tenasket in the state of Washington, was dubbed the hate capital of Canada. Why? Because one individual said, I believe in freedom of speech, and I will grant space to whomever is prepared to pay the tariff. Well, the town council denied him. And part of our mission statement as a free speech group is when somebody's under attack, we want to be there to help them. So we thought we'd put on a free speech conference right there in Oliver, B.C. And what we wanted to do was to try to explain to the town's folks what an ISP is, because a lot of lies and rumors were spread. There was kiddie porn. That had nothing to do with that. And there was hate. And people, I guess, got the idea if you turned on your computer, you know, Adolf Hitler would jump through the screen at you. There was a lot of ignorance. So we thought, well, we'll have a conference. And we scoured around, and we found, well, we'll rent municipal property, and we had nothing to hide. Well, of course, the forces of repression were not long in getting our conference canceled. Just one of the lines they use quite often, it's very effective. They say, well, there could be trouble. Well, yes, that's what we have the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Force, where perhaps they could extract themselves from the donut shop long enough to prevent trouble. Anyway, the town council caved, and we said, no, we're going to have our conference anyway. So a man who was a World War II veteran, served in the British Army, who was a great columnist, now dead, Doug Collins, I, a couple of other people, Bernard Klatt, said, we're going to have our press conference and whatever we can of our meeting on the town hall steps, right in front of a memorial for those who fell in two world wars, supposedly to secure freedom. And we did. And the red mob were out there, you know, racists and fascists have no right to speak. But it all went across fairly well. And that was just the first of many battles over the internet in Canada. I don't know what we accomplished right after September the 11th in terms of fighting terrorism. We passed an anti-terrorism bill called Bill C-36. The major source of terrorism, of course, is immigration. We have Sikh terrorists. We may have some Muslim terrorists. We have Tamil terrorists. If you want to crack down on terrorism, you crack down on immigration. What they did is crack down on the internet. So they turned control of the internet over to the Canadian Human Rights Commission. We had previously, under different legislation, battled for 6 years to protect the Zundel site. We failed, but that's what we were trying to do. That was a further escalation in the war on the internet. But what they did with the anti-terrorism legislation is they turned the internet entirely over to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, and to make a very long story short, there really is no protection. If the section of the Human Rights Act says that repeated communications that are likely to expose any of a long list of privileged minorities to hatred or contempt are discriminatory practice and therefore forbidden. Now, of course, the important words there are likely. What is likely to expose to hatred or contempt? Well, lawyers can feast on that word, likely. It has to be no proof that anybody actually turned into a red-eyed demon with hatred because of what was said. And contempt, of course, is such a broad term, any serious criticism might hold somebody up to contempt. And unlike other legislation, truth is no defense. So essentially, the Canadian Human Rights Commission can go after any dissident website it doesn't like. And they've been doing that. And there's one particular hatchet man named Richard Warman. He's a lawyer for the Canadian Human Rights Commission. And he has a neat modus operandi. He goes after American internet service providers for Canadian websites and tries to intimidate them. If the Americans hang tough, he then charges the Canadian owner of the site, and if that owner has the temerity to criticize Warman, he then sues them for libel. I'm currently facing a libel suit because I called him an enemy of free speech. Well, he is. You know, a person who tries to take away other people's freedom is an enemy of free speech. So that's the atmosphere of oppression on the internet front, and it's of course a very important front because it's one of the few relatively untrammeled weapons that we have left. Another element of repression is Canada Customs. So if you come to Canada, I would suggest that you not come with any political literature or religious literature. You can bring along some porn if you like. They're not too worried about that, but they are very worried about ideas. I used to be in teaching until organized Jewish groups put a lot of pressure on the Board of Education and got me fired after a 26-year career. But one of my many crimes was that I organized a free speech conference in 1996. So I've always kind of been interested in the teaching profession. So I never did this, but we used to do something called show and tell. So here I've got something that I find it's kind of my little mascot. It's my rat. And I keep it in my briefcase, and I always enjoy going through the security screening, and uh, I, I, and Actually, I don't do it to annoy these people, but I hear this lady saying, that man has a mouse in his briefcase. She says, do you have a mouse in your briefcase? I said, no, I have a rat. A rat. Why do you have a rat, sir? I said, I have a rat because it reminds me of Canada Customs. Oh, she says, and laughs. I think a lot of these people have an equally contemptuous view of Canada Customs. So anyway, here's my pet rat. I am hoping for the day when some female customs employee is rooting through my briefcase, after rooting through my underwear, after rooting through my clothes, and comes upon the rat and screams. And I'm going to say, with my sweetest demeanor, didn't your mommy ever tell you shouldn't touch other people's things? Anyway, Canada Customs has a widespread mandate to interdict difficult, dangerous things coming into Canada. Weapons? Not much success with that, because we have these Indian reservations that straddle the borders where we're getting weapons coming in like mad. They're supposed to interdict drugs. Well, they're not too good at that either, because at least at Toronto International Airport, some of the customs officials are themselves importing drugs. But they are pretty good at interdicting something called hate propaganda. Now, hate propaganda is a very difficult term. It can mean pretty much anything they want it to mean, and it is essentially criticism of any of the usual privileged minorities. And I'm on their list. So, I will come in from the United States, and I always note how many people are on the plane, more or less. I will be the only one person. And I look at other people, there's somebody with a turban on, somebody looks as though he just escaped from Arabia, and others look as other relatively odd-looking people. I often wonder, well, why don't they look at these people? I mean, maybe they're perfectly fine individuals for all I know, but why me? Anyway, when I came back from the American Renaissance Conference, I had one of my usual encounters with them, so I'm the only one out of 45 sent over for secondary inspection. And as I go through the baggage area, I notice a plane has just come in from Cuba, filled with Canadian tourists. You see, we're allowed to go to Cuba. They don't mind. Our government doesn't mind us going to Cuba. Returning Canadian vacationers. And I figured, you know, there must be some of these guys maybe bringing in a few more cigars than they're allowed, or an extra bottle of liquor, or maybe even some drugs, for all I know. Maybe they'll call some of these people over. And I'll know who they are, because unlike the rest of us, who are all kind of pale because it's late February, these people will all be nicely tanned, wearing their tropical duds and so on. Well, of course, not a single one of them was pulled over. I estimate in the 2 hours I was detained, at least 400 people came through that terminal, and I was the only one pulled over. So I come up to the secondary inspection, and they run my passport through, and the guy is looking. I'll call him Baldy. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but you see, our officials, as in any third-world dictatorship, are cowards. Nobody has a name, of course. And they won't give you their name. You know, I have to give them my passport. I can't say, I'm 007 or something. I have to tell my name, but they don't have to tell me theirs. And, of course, this makes the would-be bully and thug all the more encouraged. You know, if you can act anonymously, you're prepared to do things you might not be prepared to do if you actually had to give your name. So anyway, Baldy starts, puts my passport through, and it's quite clear to me he doesn't know what he's supposed to be looking for. So he does the usual thing. He's going through my newspaper clippings. You see, when I travel, I read the newspapers I didn't get a chance to read before I left. So I clip out clippings. He says, well, what do you do? And I thought, well, should I tell him what I do? And you see, these people have no sense of humor. I was prepared to say something like, well, I'm a gentleman. That used to be a highfalutin way of saying you're unemployed. Or independently wealthy. Well, I'm not independently wealthy. Anyway, I said, well, I work for a free speech foundation. Oh. Well, what does this, why do you have this? This is a newspaper clipping about immigration. Well, I said, it interests me. Oh. And, you know, for half an hour, why do I have this clipping? Why do I have that clipping? Why do I have this? Well, he's quite clearly not getting too far. He said, well, have you had trouble with the customs before? I said, oh, I always have trouble with the customs here. I don't in the third world, but I do here. Why? I said, because I annoyed Fat Eleanor. Huh? Who's Fat Eleanor? I said, your former boss, Eleanor Kaplan. She was the Minister of Immigration before she was Minister in Charge of Customs, and I annoyed her because I and my organizations criticized her so severely. You see, she was the Yad Vashem poster girl of the year for 1999, and she won the Yad Vashem Award because, and in her acceptance speech, she said that her proudest moment was not the moment she became Minister of Immigration, but when she had the opportunity to sign the deportation and denaturalization orders for two old German Canadians who had never committed a crime in Canada. And she said, when I did that, I said the Kaddish. I think that's the Kaddish, not the radish. But anyway, she, in other words, we had an ethnic agenda being implemented by our Minister of Immigration, who was operating for Israeli interests, her own ethnic interests, and not Canadian interests. And we've criticized her repeatedly. So I said, I annoyed Fat Eleanor, which is always a good way to get a conversation going. Well, he didn't make too much of that. He continues to root around. He says, what's this? I said, it's one of five books I brought back from Washington. It's the Germanic myths. And it's an explanation of what's in the myths by Jacob Grimm, of Grimm Brothers. I thought, well, maybe I can move this process along. I said, well, that's one of the Grimm Brothers, you know, who wrote the Grimm fairy tales. You know, like Hansel and Gretel. But Baldy is not a reader. It's quite clear this is going to take quite a while, so I reach into my pocket, see, more show and tell, and took out my cell phone, and I start to dial because there's somebody I'm supposed to meet. And, you know, I'm already going to be at least half an hour late, so I'm trying to make my phone call. But suddenly, some long, tall drink of water, a fellow I call McGeek comes along, and you know, he's got to put me in my place. You can't do that. I said, what do you mean I can't do that? You can't use your cell phone here. I said, why not? You can't. It's against regulations. I said, am I under arrest? You can't use it here. So I'm arguing with him, and along somebody at my shoulder starts chattering at me. I told you this before. I look around, and it's Soldier Wannabe. Soldier Wannabe is about 5'3", receding hairline, the remnants of a brush cut. He's a guy, you know, who probably wanted to be a cop or a soldier and didn't make it. And like any little guy in a situation like that, he's a jumped up bully. I've had trouble with Soldier Wannabe before. So anyway, he's giving me a hard time, and he says, I told you back in December. I said, I never talked to you in December. He's the one who sent me to the penalty box back in November. In November, when I came through, I got into an argument with some woman at the secondary inspection, and he came along and said that I was harassing her. I was only asking her some questions, and of course, I suppose for people of low intelligence, any questions are harassment. But so I was told I could go, I had to go and sit on the bench, you know, like two minute penalty for talking. And I said, well, I want to take one of my newspapers. He says, you can't. I said, why not? Why can't I take my newspaper? He said, because it could be treated with some substance. How do I know it's a newspaper? I said, well, you can tell it's a newspaper because here it says Globe and Mail. You know, that's one of our two national newspapers. And you see there's print here. It's a newspaper. I said, you might have some substance on it. So I was sent to the penalty box without a newspaper. Anyway, Soldier Wannabe's on my case. And so finally I appealed to the boss. Now, the boss is a short man. He's clearly the boss of the operation. I'd heard him say as soon as I got in there to somebody else, it's a quiet day today, and we want to keep it that way. What that means is they didn't want to do their job. And like, you could see that. There were about six of them in there. Two of them were having coffee and donuts. One was munching down his lunch. Two others were talking. I overheard them say that some guy over there was a real hunk. And there was one person sort of in a lonely position manning her post. Well, I'm going to... There's lots more that happened that was humorous and otherwise. At the end of the day, though, oh yes, Charlie Chan came along. Charlie Chan is a sort of a second, somewhat higher than the ordinary guys, but not as high as the boss. So Charlie Chan has dealt with me before, and he really doesn't like me. So they told Charlie Chan, well, it's this guy. So Charlie Chan goes into the back room. They have a conference, and then he gets sent somewhere else, and he's on the computer, and I guess he's trying to find out what I'm all about. And and there's more conferencing. At the end of 2 hours, to make a very long story a little shorter, they decide to take every single one of my books, 5 copies of Germanic Mythology, 2 copies of a book by a fellow named Laskin, I think, that was a series of quotations about the social sciences, and 1 copy, and this is a very subversive book, by Roger Pearson, Heredity and Humanity. That book is prohibited from Canada as hate propaganda. It's a study, a scientific, academic study of the eugenics movement. And every 3 months, the customs censors publish a list of what they've done in the past 3 months. So that will be all the literature, tapes, even news, even book lists. In fact, there's a Sons of Freedom organization in Louisiana. At one point, their book list was banned. So they have this list of all the literature, tapes, videotapes seized in the past 3 months of what happened. So you get this list, and then you find out many of these were cleared. And on this one particular list a few years ago, while there were scientific academic books, including one on censorship in the United States, a book on Shockley, and a book on bias in academe, which is another book by Roger Pearson's organization about the attack on scholars like Shockley and others. Those were banned, but a videotape called Anal Sluts was not. Now, I've never seen the videotape, and I have no idea what it's about, but it did somewhat strike me as odd. I mean, I'm not for banning anything, really, but it did strike me as odd that academic books forbidden, anal sluts not. And I've mentioned this to various audiences, and it strikes me that really is what's going on here is this. They don't care if you watch anal sluts till your eyes bug out, because it doesn't matter. You're harmless. It's like in the old Soviet Union, they didn't care if Ivan drank vodka till he passed out. He can even be causing the state any trouble if he's pie-eyed on cheap vodka. However, dissident political or religious literature, that worries them, because if you're informed, you might get active, and if you get active, maybe their rotten days will one day be over. Well, that's a quick view of Canada customs. Anonymous, lazy, stupid, and repressive. Now, I should have brought it up for show and tell as well, but David Duke's new book, Jewish Supremacism, banned. We call them the book burners, and that's not a metaphor. It's quite literally true. One of my compatriots asked Canada Customs, what do you do with the books you seize after the appeals time is over? She told him, we burn them. Now, we had a rash of so-called anti-Semitic incidents in late March and early April. And I say so-called because I'm somewhat cynical. I went to school for a bit of time down in Missouri, and I think you can say, especially when you start running into anti-Semitic incidents, you ought to adopt the attitude of, I'm from Missouri, prove it to me. We had things like the toppling over of tombstones in Jewish graveyards. Now, they were so carefully toppled by these vandals, whoever they were, but the tombstones were gently pushed off their base. So, yes, it would probably cost a bit of money to get a workman to lift them back up and put them on the base. And for all I know, maybe it was done by some vandals with a negative Jewish agenda. However, there have been enough examples around the world where those actions are done by these people themselves for sympathy that you will forgive me for being just a little bit cynical. Anyway, one of the incidents was the firebombing of a Jewish school's library in Montreal. And this was a fantastic photo opportunity the next morning. The politicians were falling over themselves to be there and to commiserate and to carry on. And our Jewish Minister of Justice said that it was a terrible thing that we have come to this pass where anti-Semites are burning books. And I thought, Mr. Kotler, all you have to do is talk across the cabinet table to the minister and your colleague, Mrs. McClellan, the minister in charge of national security, who's now in charge of the customs, and say to her, you know, I'm worried about this book burning business. It's a bad thing. It's bad if vandals do it, but it's even worse when the government does it. Cut it out. The topic I'd like to share with you and conclude with this afternoon, of course, is Canada's most famous political prisoner, Ernst Zundel. I know many of you know a lot about him, and on the other hand, some of you may not know a great deal about him, so I'd like to put you in the picture without getting too much deeply into the legalese. Ernst Zundel was born in 1939, on April the 24th, 1939, in the Black Forest area of southern Germany. And earlier on in the current rounds of hearings, he said that he owed his life to Adolf Hitler. And he explained that when the rather stunned judge asked him how that could be. He said, well, my family was very poor. And when Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933, my father at long last had reliable employment and was then in a position to have a family. And had it not been for that, and if it had not been for Adolf Hitler, I would not have been born. And in that sense, he said, I owe my life to Adolf Hitler. Ernst Zundel early on showed a great promise as an artist, took training in art in Germany, and in 1958 emigrated to Canada. I perhaps didn't mention he comes from a Seventh-day Adventist background, and that means he's a pacifist. And he is a pacifist. He chose Canada as opposed to the United States or Australia because in 1958 we did not have a draft. We did not draft young men into the army. He did not believe in military service as such. He became, over the next decade or so, a very big success. He got into photo retouching in the early days, and he had contracts with some of the major department stores and companies that produce catalogs. So he did very, very well. He had his own studio, had a number of employees, and was financially very, very well off. And he began to be the sort of person many other German immigrants of his generation looked to for leadership. Now, as the years went on and we moved into the late 1970s, something odd began to happen. Right after the war, in the early 50s and the 60s, there was a real live-and-let-live attitude. There were a lot of older Germans and a lot of new German immigrants in Canada, a lot of immigrants from other places, Italy, the Balkans, from Britain, and so on. And although the war had just ended and there had been, there was a certain degree of, I guess, hard feeling, There developed very quickly a live-and-let-live attitude that I recall hearing from my parents, and both my parents served in the Canadian Army, although I think my dad kind of wonders why he ever served in the Royal Canadian Navy, because certainly the behavior of the country that Canada has become is not the behavior of the country he went to war believing he was fighting for freedom. Anyway, that generation, though, said things like, you know, those guys in Germany, they were just like we. We serve because king and country called us. They serve because their country called them. We all had to do our duty. You know, look, let's live and let live. Let's go do our jobs, raise our families, and so on. So the animosity, when I first became relatively conscious of these things, at the school I went to, there were a fair number of German kids, and, you know, the German kids were called Krauts, but it didn't mean anything. The Italians were called Wops. It didn't mean anything. It was just joshing. And everybody really worked together. There was really no or very little animosity, you know, 15, 20 years after the war. But along come the late 70s, and we start hearing about something called the Holocaust, with a big H, capital H. When I was taking religion in high school, I remembered something called a Holocaust, but that was a burnt offering in the Old Testament. So it took a while to figure out what this Holocaust with a capital H was. And Ernst Zundel's friends were saying to him, our kids, this would be in the late 70s in school, are being discriminated against. Teachers are talking about the Germans, not the Nazi regime or Adolf Hitler or particular units, but the Germans, the whole people. The Germans killed the Jews. The Germans exterminated. And, you know, teachers often aren't up on the latest science, so kids were being told that their parents. The Germans had made Jews into soap and Jews into lampshades and so on. And so little German-Canadian kids are coming home crying. And so Ernst Rundle started an organization to try to set the record straight and try to defend them. And his initial approach was that of a civil rights fighter, saying, no, it's not fair. First of all, it's not fair to blame kids that weren't even born then for what may or may not have happened from 39 to 45. Secondly, you wouldn't do that to any other group. At that point, the Soviet Union was still in place. Some people knew about the gulags, but nobody would say the little Ivan with a Russian name is a Russian surname is somehow to blame for what happened over there. All the Russians are dastardly people. No, you wouldn't say that about any group except Germans. So he advanced. He did that type of thing, and they had protests and letters to the editor. As he moved along, he began to find out that the arguments that might work in other contexts didn't work here. That there was something special about the Second World War, and it had to do with the Holocaust. And he came to believe, and I think many of us do, that the Holocaust is not an account of a period of time, because no other period of time, no matter how controversial, does not allow you to have a debate. Now, your country was torn apart by the war between the states, but it's quite possible to have an intelligent argument about the facts of what you call your civil war, even though you lost 600,000 people. So it really cut to the quick of your country, but you can have an argument about it. You can advance arguments supporting the southern side or the northern side, and nobody says you have to be shut up and hauled off to prison. And it's the same thing about any other issue you'd care to imagine. And so what Ernst Zundel eventually concluded was that this wasn't about history at all, but this is a religious myth. And this religious doctrine has a number of key points to it. First of all, In between 39 and 45, 6 million, and not a single body less, Jews were exterminated by the Nazi regime. Most of them were exterminated in gas chambers, and subsequently cremated in places like Auschwitz and other so-called concentration camps. All of this was done on direct orders of a madman named Adolf Hitler. So that's point number three. Point number four is that this was the absolute worst atrocity in all of human history. Now, the problem with this is that with a religious dogma, it's very difficult to argue against it reasonably. And I think this has been the history of perhaps the last 20 years of the revisionist movement. The revisionists perhaps did not fully understand that this was religion rather than history. And so Ernst Zundel began to produce material critical of what I call the Hollywood version of World War II. For instance, there was a questioning of the figure of the 6 million, and many of you know the arguments far better than I. And those who saw this as a historical rather than a religious situation were probably quite amazed at the reaction of the Zionist lobby. And that was absolute hysteria. When you said, well, perhaps it wasn't 6 million, but a figure considerably less. If you asked, if you told the average Irishman, listen, we've done some research, and demographers now think that it wasn't 1.5 to 2 million Irishmen who perished in the potato famine, but say 500,000. The average Irishman wouldn't rant and rave, go red in the face, and say, "You're anti-Irish. I won't be happy till I know that at least 2 million of my fellow Irishmen perished." I mean, it's insane. Who would greet the news that not as many of your compatriots died as you'd first thought, well, with outrage and anger? But we're dealing with religion. Well, Ernst Zundel put out books. He put out, and he's not an original researcher. He published the works of other people. He commissioned studies. He commissioned a study that I think is over there on the book table of aerial photographs of the concentration camps. And the people who can read aerial photographs were able to say that some of the standard so-called evidence had been doctored, and others of those photographs showed that the standard stories about Auschwitz were simply not true. So he published things like that. He commissioned Fred Leuchter to go to Auschwitz and do forensic studies on the buildings that were supposedly used as gas chambers, and Leuchter came back with his conclusions that those buildings could not have been used for the purposes that we were told by the Hollywood version. In fact, as I understand what Leuchter said, they were so, these buildings were so not airtight that if that type of substance had been dropped in there, it would have gassed the surrounding German soldiers, and as we don't have any accounts of that. So the story could not be true. Anyway, Ernstingel put out a lot of material like this, and needless to say, he quickly found out that Canada's for free speech, but not for him. He went through a tremendous amount of harassment. His mailing privileges were taken away for a year. He went through 9 years of two trials under an archaic law called the False News Law. He was eventually acquitted and the law overturned by the Supreme Court of Canada. But for 9 years, he was gagged. He was not allowed to talk about the events of World War II. So although he legally won the case in the end, he's paid with 9 years of virtual silence. No sooner had that happened the organized Jewish groups were after him again, and they went after it after the outlet called the Zundel site. Those hearings went from 1996 to 2002 before there was a final decision. In 2000, for a number of reasons, he decided that Canada really could not any longer protect him, and that he would be better off in the United States. So he moved to the United States. He married Ingrid Rimland and moved to East Tennessee in 2000, and was really in many ways politically in semi-retirement until February 5th, 2003. He was arrested by your INS officials, and within 2 weeks deported, and he is banned from returning to the United States for 20 years, by which time he would be 84 and Ingrid Rimland 87. I'm going to skip over the entire American aspect of the case. I know his feeling is that he was a victim of judicial kidnapping, and that your laws were violated 9 ways to Friday. That's currently being fought before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, and the case is moving very, very slowly. He was deported to his country of last residence, which was Canada. I'm going to skip over a lot of the initial legal maneuverings, but on May 1st, and I think dates are significant, aren't they? You know, May 1st, May Day, he was served with what's called a Canadian National Certificate Certificate. Canadian National Security Certificate. It's issued by our security service, the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, and it alleged that Ernstingel was a terrorist, and that Ernstingel was involved in serious acts of violence against people in Canada and in Germany. So that's the contention. Now, in a case like that, the only thing standing between the person given such a certificate and a plane ride to his home country is a federal judge. And a federal judge will conduct a hearing to determine the reasonableness of the certificate. Now, that all sounds so very bland, doesn't it? And I think if you use as your reference point the TV program Law and Order, you're probably thinking what I've told you is that the Crown has to prove that Ernstingel is in fact a terrorist beyond a reasonable doubt. But that's not what they have to prove. All they have to prove is that when the two ministers signed this certificate, that it was reasonable for them to do so. Reasonable. And the Crown Attorney has said on a number of occasions, I do not have to prove the truth of this. So so as truth is no defense before Canadian Human Rights Tribunals, this judge is also not interested in the truth, only whether it was reasonable. And the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service has produced a 52-page document that is a collection of guilt by association. I'll give you an example of one piece of evidence why Ernstingel is a terrorist. Ernstingel is connected with, they love that word, connected with, because it can mean anything and nothing. Ernstingel is connected with William Pierce, Dr. William Pierce. Dr. William Pierce wrote a book called The Turner Diaries. Timothy McVeigh read the Turner Diaries. Timothy McVeigh set off a bomb that blew up the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, which killed 152 people. Therefore, Ernst Zundel's a terrorist. Okay. Well, there are a lot of problems with that. Well, to what extent was Ernst Zundel connected with Dr. William Pierce? Well, he heard two lectures by Dr. Pierce in the early 1970s in Toronto, period. Did Pierce write the Turner Diaries? Yes, he did. Did Timothy McVeigh read the Turner Diaries? Well, some people say he did. Did Timothy McVeigh blow up the Murrah Building? Well, a U.S. court said he did. I think there are a whole lot of people who think maybe he didn't, and so on. Does that make Ernst Zundel a terrorist? Well, that's one of their best pieces of evidence, too. There's all sorts of guilt by association, all sorts of individuals he's known, and one of these individuals may have been convicted of producing so-called hate propaganda in Germany. What does that have to do with terrorism? That's the public case. And you would think, well, Ernst Zundel will walk. But you see, the judge doesn't have to find that Ernst Zundel's a terrorist. All he has to find is that all this collection of associations might make a reasonable person think that Ernst Zundel might be a terrorist. I'll give you an example. Supposing when you came in today, you asked a person, who is Mark Weber? And they pointed to that fellow over there. And you ask another person, do you know Mark Weber? And that person says, I know Mark Weber. It's that fellow over there. And you ask a third person, who's Mark Weber? And that person points to that gentleman over there. It would not be unreasonable for you to think that that gentleman is Mark Weber. Now, he isn't, of course, but it would not be unreasonable for you to think so. That's all the Crown has to do. But that, as that sounds, it gets worse. Before every one of our couple of days of hearings, the judge will conduct a secret hearing. The Canadian Security and Intelligence Service will come forth before the judge and will present a witness, perhaps, a document, evidence. We don't know. But there will be evidence heard in secret, and we will not know what the evidence is. In fact, we will not even know what the charges are. It is impossible to mount a reasonable legal defense. In fact, it has gotten so absurd that we are only allowed to question the what's called the unclassified material. We're only allowed to question what's in the unclassified material. So the new lawyer Peter Lindsay has done is he started off by asking, okay, you allege Ernst Zundel had connections with this individual. Do you have any evidence that Ernst Zundel has ever done anything that would compromise Canada's national security? Did he ever advocate violence? Did he ever advocate an act of terrorism or participate in an act of terrorism with this individual? And the answer from the one witness that we have gotten, the government provided no witnesses. It's just a stack of paper. The one witness we called, who's only a spokesman for the security service, he said, not in the unclassified material. So for individual after individual after individual, every one of the 54 individuals or organizations mentioned in the public report, there is absolutely no evidence that Ernst Zundel ever committed or encouraged or promoted any acts of violence or terrorism with these people. So the logical question is, you don't have to tell me what the evidence is, but is there any evidence in the classified material? Oh, national security. That term has been used more often than hello and goodbye during the trial. National security. So we don't even have a right to know whether there's classified evidence that this individual, Ernst Zundel, ever committed an act of violence. Because, of course, if we knew that, we would be able to bring forth evidence that wasn't the case. But it has gotten so ridiculous. Last week, on the 13th, the defense lawyer Peter Lindsay said to the representative of the National Security Service, okay, in your 52-page report, give me your best shot. What in the unclassified material is your best piece of evidence that Ernst Zundel is a terrorist? National security. So there's a bit, there's a long argument over that, and in the end the judge said that he could not answer that. He would not be allowed to answer that question. He's not even allowed to tell us that in the unclassified material what he thinks is the best piece of evidence. The Crown lawyer said, the Crown attorney, Mr. McIntosh, said, well, it's a holistic document. It has to be taken as a whole, which is just a windy way of saying there's nothing in it. So what Ernst Sundell faces is secret evidence in secret hearings. When the judge, when the hearings are over and the judge makes a decision, that decision, if it's negative, becomes an unappealable deportation warrant. If the decision is made today, the next day Ernst Sundell will be on a plane to Frankfurt and almost certainly a five-year prison term in Germany, because there he has violated their extremely draconian laws. One of them involves showing disrespect to the memory of the dead, which means questioning the Hollywood version of World War II. Ernst Sundell has been kept in solitary confinement since he arrived in Canada on February 17, 2003, in conditions that violate all basic decencies. His toiletries, including his toothbrush, are kept outside his cell. So if he has to go to the bathroom and wants to wash his hands afterwards, he has to call a guard, and the guard may or may not come, and to pass him his soap, or if he wishes to brush his teeth, his toothbrush, in a prison where they're worried about the spread of SARS and AIDS and hepatitis. It's dehumanizing for that to happen. There's a light on in his cell 24 hours a day. Ernst Sundell noticed bleeding in his gums in May of 2003. He asked to see a dentist. He was not allowed to see a dentist until late January of this year, by which time he had severe periodontal problems. He was given antibiotics to deal with those, and the antibiotics have such a bad effect on him that when he testifies into the afternoon, as he did a little over a month ago, he turned ghostly pale and was at some points not even making sense. And I said to Peter Lindsay at the break on that particular day, Peter, what's the matter? He says, it's these antibiotics he's taking. And he said, well, I guess I'll ask the judge to maybe adjourn the session a little earlier this afternoon. I said, Peter, not a little earlier, now. And so right after the break, Peter Lindsay got a very reluctant judge to adjourn the session. I see my time is, in a sense, drawing to a close, so I do want to point out just a couple of other things. If the situation sounds bad already, it gets even worse. The judge is a former director of our intelligence service. It is as if you had a national security case involving your CIA, and the judge in the case had been a former director of the CIA. Could that judge be seen to render a fair verdict? Well, we don't think so. Well, in fact, Mr. Sundell's previous lawyer, Doug Christie, asked the judge, Mr. Justice Pierre Blais, to recuse himself or take himself off the case in November. He refused, and it's our belief The Judge Blais has been sent in there to commit a judicial assassination of Ernst Sundell. He is going to do to Ernst Sundell what the Israeli Apache gunships did to Sheikh Yassin. He is there to do a job. He's a reliable, trusted member of the federal elite, and his job is to push this thing through and get Ernst Sundell deported. That sounds all very negative, and it sounds as if I'm saying there's no hope. Well, there certainly is hope. We have an appeal in the Provincial Court of Appeals under the Habeas Corpus Act. And what we are arguing is that the important aspects of the law under which Ernst Sundell is being punished are unconstitutional. For instance, the secret hearings. We fought in the Anglo-Saxon world for 1,000 years to develop the legal system we have today, where the accused has a right to know the charges against him so that he might answer them, and to face his accusers. That, we believe, is unconstitutional. The present act is unconstitutional. The fact that there is no appeal against the judge's decision is another ground, and a final ground is that anything is permitted as evidence. Not the sort of evidence that would be allowed in a normal court of law, anything. And that's a lot of what we face. We face volumes like this of newspaper clippings, some 25 or 30 years old. And as Doug Christie said, how do I cross-examine a newspaper clipping? In a normal court of law in Canada, you'd not be able to walk a newspaper clipping in and say, this is proof of something. The rules would require you to call the reporter or to call somebody who had something to do with that newspaper article in order to bring it in as evidence. But anything is permitted under the present law. So that's going to be appealed. When I was on the way here, I talked to one of Ernst's lawyers, and the recommendation is that we take this appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada and ask for an expedited hearing and ask as well for a stay in the present proceedings, because they are trying to frog march Ernst Zundel to a quick judgment and then out of the country. This is going to cost about $75,000 Canadian. That's roughly $50,000 American. Ernst Zundel needs your help. He's received a lot of help from people here, a lot of help from people across Canada. There's going to be more mentioned about this later, but we do have a collection box over there for him. We also have some of his hand-drawn paintings from prison. Anything you want to throw in, and you take one of those hand-drawn paintings. We also have reproduced on slightly better paper prints of some of his better artwork. He's in prison. He is not allowed a pen. It took us 6 months to get him allowed a magic marker to highlight material for his court appearances. He is only allowed children's colored pencils, but the works that he produces are done in prison with children's colored pencils. I'm going to conclude with something. When I remember when I was growing up, always being intrigued by escape stories. And I grew up reading things like The Great Escape, which was later made into a movie, Colditz Castle, about Wing Commander Bader, who lost both his legs and still managed to escape from a German POW camp. And in the course of that, I recall reading that every so often the prisoners, now they're the ones held by those bad Germans, would get Red Cross packages that contained tea and coffee and soap and toothpaste and writing material. There isn't a single one of those items you can send Ernst Zundel. He's in a Canadian prison in solitary confinement, and he has fewer rights than our POWs did in Nazi Germany at time of war. It sure does make you think. Thanks.